this is the Poor People's Campaign, so we're going to start this up with song, okay? And we're going to sing a song maybe many of you probably aren't familiar with, but we're going to teach it to you right now. It's real easy.
On a Monday evening this past June, a few dozen people stood at the bottom of the steps of the Utah Capitol and sang a song.
Way too long.
They met to take part in the last Moral Monday of the Poor People's Campaign's 40 Days of Nonviolent Direct Action.
Somebody's hurting our people, and it's gone on far too long. Gone on far too long. Gone on far too long. Somebody's hurting our people, and it's gone on far too long. And I won't be silent anymore.
50 years after the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., community organizers nationwide are breathing new life into a movement that King initiated, with a focus on uniting people, on moral grounds, against poverty, as he addressed in his speech, The Other America.
In this America, millions of work-starved men walk the streets daily in search for jobs that do not exist. In this America, millions of people find themselves living in rat-infested, vermin-filled slums. In this America, people are poor by the millions, and they find themselves perishing on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity.
This is In the Hive. I'm Emily Means. Reverend Monica Hall, a minister with Trinity Presbyterian Church in Ogden, led the rally in Salt Lake and has been the face of the Poor People's Campaign in Ogden since May. I asked Reverend Hall to talk about the campaign as a continuation of King's vision.
Martin Luther King had drawn a connection between poverty, racism, and militarism. And those were his three sort of the stool by which this campaign was set upon. And linking that whenever you're poor, who's being targeted poor was basically sometimes of color, but sometimes not. There's a lot of poor white people as well. People who feel like they couldn't vote because there was not an ability to, or they didn't feel like anybody was working on their behalf. And then the policing of the nation through legislation or through even local law enforcement that kept those things in check from keeping people of poverty or of color getting too much power. Of course, I'm sort of summarizing a really massive topic. You know, you can unpack this for days. But this is sort of his, and we're sticking with these three things, knowing that our allegiance of justice to one another in the sense of loving neighbor, wanting equality for all, caring for our planet, and not harming anyone. Like, we should all be working to better one another. These things are very intricately aligned with the campaign. And sometimes I wonder about it being called the Poor People's Campaign, because a lot of people are like, I'm not poor. What do the poor have to do with me? But really, it's poor in spirit, definitely economically poor, but poor in rights, poor inequality, poor, you know, like there's just a lot of the overall sort of idea of poorness, mm-hmm. not being full, not being overabundant.
So how did you as a clergy member in Utah get involved in something like this?
It's an interesting thing. In 2016, I'm not a political junkie, but I do care about what's happening in the laws of our nation. And in the summer of 2016, I watched both the Republican National Convention and the Democratic National Convention. And at the beginning of the DNC, a clergy person came and gave the invocation for the convention. And it was Dr. Barber, William Barber. And I'd never heard of him before, and I'm sure I was late to the party on this or whatever. And this was 2 years ago. And what he said in this prayer was quite evoking for me. And there was a fire that got lit. And so I started following him. And then because of the social media, the campaign, I began to learn more about it. And I saw all the eastern part of the United States really engaging in this, especially in the South, engaging. And I thought, we need some work here, too. And I started doing some research in Ogden and the poverty statistics in Ogden. So I thought, it's not Salt Lake. People who live in poverty work all the time. They're sometimes not being able to pay attention to what is happening legislatively. So I just decided that, you know, maybe I should check this out.
Did you feel a calling, I guess?
Yeah, I guess, you know, I don't know how people feel that necessarily, but it won't leave you alone and it nags you, you know, you must do something. And I guess one day I'd sort of said, maybe I just need to let someone else do this. And I guess it was Cecile Richard. I'd read something that she said that day, and she said, you don't wait on someone to give you permission to organize. You get up and do it. You don't need someone's permission. And I think it was that day I just went, okay. And so I went to the city and did some work for the Diversity Commission there and sort of partnered to say, I think this is something we should talk about and take action on. And they agreed. And so that's how it began.
So from what I can tell, the Poor People's Campaign isn't looking for any specific legislative action necessarily, but you're hoping to appeal to moral values. Do you think that's a harder sell for some people?
Maybe, especially where we live. This campaign talks about values. I'm often quite struck that we live in this place, and in particularly in Utah, where values are a lot of things that they encloak a lot of things that we talk about. These are our values. And I think this campaign is just really a nice way to offer back, is this the value of any of our faith systems that live here? I mean, is this a teaching that we should just accept that poor people, you know, and it's tough, the system and makes you, you know, allows you to be poor, keeps you in poverty. Is that really what our faith systems value? And so for me, that question is central to this campaign, and especially where we live. I think that it can be difficult to look at someone in a partisan way and say, what do you value? You know, is it just that the red wins, or is it just that the blue wins, or is it that the citizens, the residents of this place, of this who live here win? I think that is a more difficult, because I think it's just for so long been a check the box on either side of the ballot.
Yeah, well, talking about partisan politics, one of the principles of the campaign is that it will not be partisan in any way. But some of these ideas stemming from this campaign are, you know, kind of radical to some people. How do you pull people in from either side of the political spectrum?
Tell me radical.
I think maybe some people might perceive these in one political ideology or other. For example, you know, bringing up law enforcement and militarism. Say Black Lives Matter, and someone will tell you Blue Lives Matter, right? That's the kind of thing I'm talking about.
Sure. I think there's a couple of catchphrases in the campaign. And when I say catchphrases, I mean, I think they're actually truth. That it's not about left or right, blue life or black life. It's about right and wrong. And I think that that's when it comes down to a moral revival, which is very much a part of this campaign. There's a need for a question of what our morality really is. Is our morality enshrined by politics, or is our politics enshrined by morality? And I'm not trying to necessarily say you can't throw those all together and find a hybrid some way there. But there, I think that in history, especially the last 20 years, we can point to particular places where our morality has been cloaked with politics, no matter what the morality was. And I think part of the campaign is just trying to flip that outside and say, no, let's talk about what our moral conscience says as a nation first, regardless of your political color. And you can talk with friends, or you can have an introspective, even reflective time within your own self of saying, what is it about when someone says Black Lives Matter, if something sparks in me, what is that about? You know, who is it I wanted to defend, or who's I want to stand up for? And and have a real critical, intelligent conversation with yourself or your friends about the implications of the divisions that are taking place within our moral conscience as a nation, our fabric, if we're to be held together by a fabric. So yes, it may be your word radical. I think that's interesting.
Maybe I'm projecting.
But it is in some sense. Some people might see nonviolent action as radical. They might see that talking about immigration or abolishing ICE as radical. In the fundamental truth is that it's all about what do we value. You know, are there people making money off of immigrants? You know, I mean, these are really, I don't think they're simple. They are part of a big systemic sort of relationship to corporation and people in America.
What do you think Utah and the United States as a whole would look like with a successful completion of this campaign? And is there even a point where this campaign can end?
I don't know. In some senses, it began and it took a dive and sort of laid in hibernation for 50 years because when Dr. King died. And to think about where we were 50 years ago and to pick up today with so much progress with technology and sort of the indoctrination or the real roots of politics and the things that happen between parties. And morality transcends those things. For me, that's what I understand about, or what means the most to me about this campaign, is that if you have an elected official who can't talk to you about the morality, air quality in Salt Lake City or around, what does it mean that lives are at stake, you know, health-wise? If you can't have a politician who can talk to you about that, that's a moral question. We can then move to whether they will act legislatively or not, but fundamentally, it's like, how much do we matter? You know, how much do our lives and the quality of our lives matter? It's not just air quality. It's healthcare. It's education. It's all kinds of things. And so to talk about success, Emily, I don't know what that might look like. First of all, I think to begin means that the citizens of Utah could ask themselves, morally, what would we like to look like as a state in the Union? How could we be a representative of a community of people that care about one another in such a way that we're like, does this hold up our values, our core values of lifting one another up? Because I really feel like this is a state where that seems to be a large narrative, mm-hmm. at least faith-wise. You know, I can't promise that, but it seems like it would be that way.
Well, Reverend Monica Hall, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
Last week, the Trump administration announced that the war on poverty, started in 1964 by President Lyndon Johnson, is over, and it was a success. The White House Council of Economic Advisers released the statement in conjunction with a report advocating for the addition of work requirements to federal safety net programs, such as SNAP, or food stamps, and Medicaid. Tracy Gruber is the senior advisor for Utah's Intergenerational Poverty Initiative. I met with Gruber in her office at the Department of Workforce Services to ask her what the administration's declaration meant for Utah's poor.
Well, I think in terms of the situation for families living in Utah, we always look at what's going on with families experiencing poverty from Utah's perspective. And Utah looks at poverty in a very unique way. There's no question that for families living in poverty that is defined as situational poverty, the programs that are in place are doing a pretty effective job of helping those families get back on their feet. There's a subset of people living in poverty that Utah is studying, and those are families experiencing intergenerational poverty. And those public assistance programs are effective, but they don't reduce poverty for that population.
So you don't feel like perhaps the war on poverty should be over for everyone?
That's right. I mean, I think families experiencing poverty have different challenges and barriers. And for some of those families, the programs that were in place from the time of the war on poverty being declared have been relatively effective. For this other population of people that we are looking at in Utah, that's not typically the case.
Okay, so you're heading this intergenerational poverty initiative, which, as I understand it, kind of stemmed from 2012 legislation. Maybe you can describe the difference between these two types of poverty that we study.
Sure. In Utah, the Intergenerational Poverty Initiative is being headed by the Lieutenant Governor. He chairs the Intergenerational Welfare Reform Commission. And the Intergenerational Poverty Mitigation Act does define what intergenerational poverty is and contrast that with a definition of situational poverty. And situational poverty are those circumstances that are one time, typically, maybe a death in the family, a loss of a job, a divorce, that causes a family to fall into poverty for a temporary period of time. They receive public assistance or other benefits, and then they're back on their feet in less than a year. Intergenerational poverty is that poverty that continues in a family from one generation to the next. Most cases, those families are receiving public assistance benefits, but the public assistance benefits are important. They help put food on the table in many situations, and maybe some additional income, but are not enough to establish the opportunities that need to be in place for a family to be self-reliant.
So how do these families fall into this situation, this cycle of poverty?
That's very complicated. If there was an easy solution, then we would fortunately have no families living in poverty. And because it's complicated, we look at data in four areas of child well-being, because all four areas of child well-being that the state is studying have to be addressed in a positive way so that children have the opportunity to be self-reliant as adults. Those areas are early childhood development, education, family economic stability, and health. So in similar fashion, if you're addressing them in a positive way, children are more likely to be successful. If they're not being addressed in a comprehensive way, then children are on a path to experience intergenerational poverty.
We are talking about kids and their parents. Maybe you can kind of describe what these people look like. Where do they live in Utah? Are there any common threads between who is experiencing intergenerational poverty?
We've been studying this in the state of Utah since 2012 and looking very carefully at the data. And what we have found is that families experiencing intergenerational poverty live throughout the state. There are maybe different rates of those families in certain communities, maybe smaller rates than in one county versus another, but they are living throughout the state of Utah. They're primarily young families with young children and primarily headed by single parents. And that's largely who the population is that we are studying.
I mean, you mentioned that they are all throughout the state, and of course we've got a huge urban center here along the Wasatch Front, and then all these different rural areas of the state. Do people in these different areas experience poverty differently?
I think what's different in the different communities are the resources that are available. Of course, resources in the more urban settings in our state are more plentiful. There's more programs in place to help families out and address their needs more so than in some of our rural counties. And when we look at the challenges that families are having, from healthcare to employment to access to early childhood programs, we see dramatic differences in how families experiencing intergenerational poverty are utilizing those resources or not utilizing them if they don't exist in our communities.
You're compiling all this data, right? You're doing this research and you're taking it to state and county leaders. What are state and county leaders doing to address these issues?
So Utah's effort is very heavily focused on getting the data understanding what's going on with the families, understanding where there might be resource gaps or needs that need to be addressed, and then making sure that limited resources are going to those areas that are revealing themselves in the data. So in terms of the county efforts, we share county level data with the counties. We have it produced for all 29 of Utah counties so that the counties can look at their data and establish their plans to reduce intergenerational poverty. And they are, in fact, doing that. We currently have 15 counties throughout the state that have reviewed their data and have either developed plans to reduce intergenerational poverty or are working toward developing plans. They are then going to implement those plans through a program that was established by the legislature during the 2018 session to allow them to move forward. Counties know their communities best. They know the resources that are available. They know the needs of the people living in their communities. So it's best addressed at the county level, and the state recognized that and is providing the support necessary to help them do that, but really letting them lead.
Is there anything in particular that you would hope the state legislature might focus on to make some positive steps, you know, whether it's healthcare or housing or whatever?
I think that there's lots of room for using the data to better prioritize and target limited resources to those that are going to benefit from those investments. I think that's particularly true in early childhood, the area of early childhood. And I think it's true in education and making sure that schools that are serving high rates of children experiencing intergenerational poverty provide the opportunities for kids to continue on a positive path in their academic careers, setting them up for a lifetime of success in their professional careers or whatever occupation they choose to get involved in. And I think in terms of health, looking at the data and seeing that lots of these families and these children have public health insurance, but in some parts of our state, there just are not providers in those areas that are there to address their health challenges. And that can present problems in a family's ability to obtain and maintain employment and attend school. And those areas, I think, are real prime for further understanding and analysis at the state level.
I guess my last question pertains to public perception of people experiencing poverty. And obviously, this initiative is driven by data. Is there anything that the data debunks, any poverty myths?
Sure. Data always has a way of providing a new lens on which to see things. And I think in the Intergenerational Poverty Initiative, that's absolutely true. I think one area is employment. We see that adults experiencing intergenerational poverty are connected to the labor force. Over 60% of them have employment in a 12-month period of time. The challenge for them is that they are sporadically attached to the labor force, meaning that maybe they work for brief periods of time and then become unemployed. But I think the myth that it dispels is that people living in poverty aren't working, nor do they want to work. And since we see that these families coming in and out of the labor force, we know that there's a strong desire to be employed. We know that for families living in intergenerational poverty, their experience cannot be resolved simply by providing more financial resources. Certainly, that's very important because the basic needs need to be met, particularly for children to thrive. But there are foundational challenges that our population living in poverty experience. And those foundational challenges, like childhood trauma and adverse childhood experiences, we now know have lasting implications for children. And that helps dispel the myth that it's just about money.
That was Tracy Gruber, senior advisor for Utah's Intergenerational Poverty Initiative. One effort to help kids meet some of the basic needs Gruber mentioned is the Summer Food Service Program. The U.S. Department of Agriculture reimburses school districts throughout Utah for every meal they serve during the summer to kids 18 and under. The Salt Lake City School District has 34 sites, including schools, parks, and the city library. Every weekday from 11 to 1, lunch attendants sit at a table in the main level of the library and help kids stuff their sacks with food. For one lunch this week, Stephanie Muntz, kitchen manager for the Salt Lake City School District, served
chicken nuggets. We're having goldfish crackers, tomatoes with ranch, as well as mango peach applesauce and regular or chocolate milk.
The sites are chosen by determining the needs of a particular area. 50% of kids in that area must qualify for free and reduced meals during the school year. Salt Lake City School District opens the meal program to all children, regardless of income. But Katie Capusta, the district's field supervisor over child nutrition programs, puts into perspective how many kids actually depend on the district for their meals.
During the school year, I have the data in front of me, so we've got 55% of the kids in our district qualified for free and reduced meals. We had 24,000 kids enrolled, 24,722, and 12,188 of them were free. So that means they're, you know, at that poverty line qualifying for food stamps or just qualifying based on low income. So during the summer, we actually feed close to 3,000 meals a day in our program. So it's not as much as we're serving during the school year, but it's still a helpful tool for parents. I know that there are some obstacles. A lot of kids, if their parents are working, can't get to the sites by themselves. We try to have them conveniently located throughout the community, but I think that's probably the reason we don't serve quite as many during the summer as we do during the school year.
At the library location, Muntz says she serves anywhere from 80 to 120 kids per day, and she wants to see even more come down for a bite to eat.
One, we are helping the children that are in need, but we also want to help mom and dad. I mean, in the summertime, the kids are home. You want to get them out of the house. You don't want to have to cook. It's hot. We'll feed them. Come down. We'll feed them lunch. You can get them out of the house, burn off some energy. We're not just at the city library. We're at a variety of parks throughout Salt Lake City. I know Liberty Park has a splash pad. Bring them down to the park. Run off some energy. Mom will feed the kids. You don't have to do dishes. You don't have to cook. We're just here for the kids. So it's all about the kids. I love feeding the kids. They're our most important asset that we have in the world, and I love it.
What are the biggest issues facing Utah's poor today? Weigh in at KCPW's Facebook page, KCPW 88.3, or feel free to email us at comments@kcpw.org with your feedback and questions. Thanks to the KCPW team for their support of this show, as well as to Andrew Shaw, who produced the show's theme music. And thank you for tuning in. You can find podcasts of In the Hive at kcpw.org. Up next is Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Emily Means. Thanks for listening.